Hello out there in internet land, and welcome once again to the D&D podcast. I'm your host, Mike Merles, and with me, as usual, is my sidekick, Jeremy Crawford. And joining us this week is Shelley Mazenoble.
That is his co-host, Whoa. Jeremy Crawford.
What, did I call you my sidekick?
Wow.
You did indeed.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to do that.
He must have met the other Jeremy Crawford.
I didn't mean to call you my sidekick. That's not how I think of you actually, like, in my spare time. By the way, I could... make some copies for me after this. I have some handouts I need for my campaign.
Only if you get me a cup of coffee.
We'll see about that.
And I have some dry cleaning.
So anyway, this week we're going to be talking about player strategy. The player strategy guide just came out. I see you have a quiz open from the player strategy guide. I don't know if you're going to be asking us questions.
I do. Well, we took a quiz from this book. About our alignment.
Yes.
All of us took this as ourselves, not as our characters.
Yeah, which was confusing when we got to the question about seeing goblins.
Yes. That's when we wanted one of the answers to be call...
a taxi.
Yeah. Call 911.
Call a taxi or 911.
I'm seeing goblins. Yeah. I don't know what I just ate.
It depends on what part of town you're in, actually.
It's true.
It's not that uncommon. But on this book, one of the reasons why I like this book personally is because of all the quizzes that are in it. And we don't have to take this whole quiz. I'm just going to ask you one question each from this. This one is, what class are you? And the question is, what does your wardrobe remind people of? A college graduation. B, an appointment they have somewhere else. C, a taxidermy shop. Or D, a scrapyard.
I was going to say, like, it just reminds you of a boring thing, because I have, like, five shirts. I own seven collared shirts, seven different colors, one for each day.
There's the green one. There's the orange one. I could probably list all of your shirts, Mike.
It's like adult garanimals.
It is. It's easy. I just get up in the morning.
The orange shirt goes with the blue pants.
Well, all I wear are jeans, though. But it's so easy in the morning when I get up. Look, I make a lot of important decisions during the day, right?
And I don't want to have to make... Hold on, wear in the morning. It's not one of them. Unlike Jeremy and myself, where I think that the most important decision of the day is what are we going to wear?
It sets the tone for
it
the
really
whole day.
It really does. Yeah, I think that people know how to interact with me that day based on what I'm wearing. Like, today is kind of like I'm putting the headphones on and...
If I wear the same shirt in a 2-week period, I feel like I'm slumming it a little bit.
Yeah, that's how I feel about my shoes, too.
So this is probably too much information for the podcast, but I wore the same outfit from Friday to Sunday because I felt I needed to go green. I'm like, I don't want to, because I saw different people every day. And my wife wasn't around for half the weekend. She was off with one of her friends. I was like,
that's how you go green?
Yeah.
You wear the same dirty clothes. There's laundry detergent that is.
Yeah, but
not,
that's like getting in the environment and killing otters and other cute things.
No, there's some that's actually good for the environment.
What cleans?
Washing your clothes is, it's okay.
I just, you know, I don't do it all the time. I just thought this weekend, I thought to myself, while I'm burning this, you know, trash can full of garbage in my backyard, I can make up for it by wearing the same clothes 3 days in a row. So what's your answer? Probably the thing about having an appointment somewhere else, because I dress in a rather boring way in the main.
Okay. Well, I don't think any of these answers really fit Jeremy.
No, I don't think so.
He's quite snappy, but yeah, I'm going to...
Snappy, that's a good word.
Well, thank you.
Like
you.
That?
Yeah.
But I have another question for you from this.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and actually your answer, you're, I don't know, you're a rogue.
I'm a rogue?
Sure. Based on the one question that I asked.
Okay, we're okay.
Jeremy, what's your best quality? I'm the smartest one in the room.
No. I'm sorry, did I say that out loud?
Mike, I know how to get out of trouble. I have a winning personality. Or I don't know how to quit.
You don't know how to quit. That's the last one. This man is his nickname in the department is Lunch Killer. Because he will schedule, we have this really important meeting.
Oh.
I'm going to schedule it for 11:55. We'll get it done in 5 minutes, and then 3 o'clock. Oh, I guess no one ate lunch today. Oh, no.
Aww.
I just want to cheat and pick whichever one will make sure that my class is wizard or cleric.
And I'm blocking the answers.
You can't cheat with this quiz the way that the scoring cue is, unfortunately.
I'm blocking it. You can't see it.
You're a wizard.
I'm a wizard.
Yeah.
Whatever.
You just picked.
I picked the class.
What's your best quality? I think I'm a wizard.
A lot of these answers would fit you. But anyway, this book, I really do like this book. It came at a rather timely time in my life, mm-hmm. as I was struggling a little bit with my wizard, Tabitha.
Who's described in the book.
Who is actually described in the book. And she's a good wizard, but I feel like she could be a better wizard. Sure, and that's not her fault. I feel like that's obviously my fault. But a lot of times when I'm playing, I don't feel like I'm playing like the best possible way.
Okay.
For instance, if there's an NPC, I don't know if I should, I feel like I'm usually the most charismatic one. I probably have the highest diplomacy.
Sure, yeah.
But I don't ever really talk. I kind of just stay in the background like, I don't want to say the wrong thing. I'm not going to ask the wrong question. So I just kind of picture Tabitha just kind of twirling her hair and standing back there like, I hope nobody talks to me. I hope nobody calls on me. I don't want to say the wrong thing. Hmm. Or if I do say something, maybe I disclose too much information.
Sure.
And then say we're in battle and should I go in the room? Should I stand here? Where should I stand? Should I stand behind something? Should I get up close? Should I just make sure I'm in range? And then when I figure that part out, well, who should I go after? I usually go after a cluster because most of my powers are bursts. But if there's no cluster, should I help the sword mage or should I just fight someone totally different? And actually the whole party struggles with this because we usually just go after separate targets and then we're dying and the monsters aren't, and it's just usually ends very badly. But when I saw this book, it made me realize. Now, I know that you guys really, I know you like me and you want me to be a good little wizard.
Sure.
But there's no way you publish this book just for me.
Well,
because there would actually be recipes in it and probably more clothing options.
Sure.
So I'm assuming there's other people that must face player insecurities. You're the experts. You work here. Mm-hmm. You contribute to the rules. You make the game. So I would imagine that people who play with you outside of here, and you do play outside.
Of course, yeah.
I would imagine they may even be a little bit insecure playing with you.
No.
In your presence.
No. I don't think so. I don't. You know, it's kind of funny. I play with really veterans. So mm-hmm. that's really the key is, because it is one of those things where I think if you start playing D&D. See, I started playing D&D with people who also were my age when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know anything about what they're doing either. So we all just kind of learned at the same time. But I think if you play with a group that has more experienced people, you do feel that kind of, I want to make sure I'm pulling my weight because it's a cooperative game.
Right. Obviously. And you don't want to feel like, I moved here and now everybody's thinking, oh, why did she go there? It's so obvious she should have moved here or something.
Mm-hmm.
But do you ever, even you guys, even who you are, do you ever experience a little insecurity in your game?
There are times where I'll make a choice and I might realize, you know, a round later, say in a battle, that, oh, you know, my wizard should have moved over there instead. You know, rather than blowing up that group of monsters, I should have blown up the other group.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what usually for me, like if I'm playing a fighter or like another type of defender type of guy, then I'm a bit more cognizant of it. But if I'm playing, see, I play wizards in the more of a gunslinger, just kind of do what I want in the wizard kind of way. I expect everyone else to follow my lead.
Really?
Well, especially depending on the character I'm playing. You know, yeah. I played a sorcerer for a while who was evil and would just, and it's in some ways a little liberating to be the one evil guy in the party because it's, you just kind of look out for yourself, you know, and.
Well, that would certainly make things easier.
It does make things easier. You know, you just kind of internalize a lot of lessons, but I think with experience becomes this sort of general ability to go to see a mistake and then, but not get too down on yourself for it. I mean, I think that's what a lot of it is just knowing you're going to make mistakes and just accepting that, I screwed up. I'll just know next time not to do that. Because I think when you are new at something, you know, actually I watched this really interesting video of a GDC talk. And one of the points the guy made was, you know, if you want to be a humble person, which is a very useful thing, especially just in any situation where you're working with other people, you don't want to get too arrogant or be too lording over other people, that to keep himself humble, he keeps seeking out new things to try. Because that is a humbling experience. Like if you try snowboarding for the first time, you're falling down all the time.
Right.
It's hard to be arrogant or, you know, cocky if you keep falling on your butt in the snow. And I think that's kind of a way to think of it in D&D is it's, you're just sort of learning something. You're going to mess up, but don't worry about it because if you mess up enough, sooner or later you will learn, right? So in some ways you kind of embrace making mistakes because that's just part of the learning process.
And also, in D&D, mistakes often lead to some of the most fun encounters.
Right.
Yes.
Especially in the hands of a skilled DM and a creative group of players, a mistake can often lead to far more amusing situations than, you know, brilliant tactics.
Yes.
Because sometimes brilliant tactics can get a little boring and rote, like, all right, you know, here's this type of encounter, wizard, the wizard does this, the fighter does that, the cleric does this other thing, and then rinse and repeat encounter after encounter. Yeah. Sometimes that misstep turns an encounter into a fresh experience, an amusing experience. Sometimes that character getting into deep, deep trouble makes the whole thing more exciting as the other characters are trying to get them out of trouble while fighting the monsters at the same time. So when I'm DMing and I see the players make what, you know, sort of from a bird's eye view is truly a tactical mistake, I try to make that mistake a benefit for the game and not punish the players for it.
Oh, you're a good DM.
I mean, they might still have to pay for it. I mean, they might, you know, go from, you know, from the frying pan into the fire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I want to make being in the fire a good time.
Wow.
And so it's a twist in the story.
You know what our DM does when he knows that we're making a very big, stupid mistake? He always goes, is that what you're going to do?
That's the code.
Instead of just saying, well, I'm going to go over here. And he'll go, is that where you're going? Are you really going there? Is that where you're going to go? You're staying there? Okay! And then you can tell, oh, this is, I just made a terrible, terrible mistake. But if you can actually make the players have some benefit from making a mistake, that shows what a good DM you are. So we were in Chicago this past weekend when the Blackhawks won Game 4.
Mm-hmm.
So we were thinking about hockey a lot this weekend. And thinking about hockey in the sense of everybody on the team has a role, similar to how everyone in a D&D party has a role. And then we were trying to figure out, well, who would be the goalie, or who would be the right wing, who would be the center?
It's tricky because I always think of it in terms of basketball.
Okay.
But if I was going to use the hockey analogy, well, I'm not sure who the wizard would be. I think the center would be the leader,
Clark.
Your defensemen are probably your fighters.
Yeah, that's...
You know,
I would agree.
I don't know who the goalie is, though. That's a really
hard... I don't know. Like, in a way, it's like, well, it could be obvious. Like, well, the goalie stays in the back, so maybe it is the wizard.
Yeah.
But I don't want to be the goalie.
Yeah, the goalie's in controller. Yeah. And
you know, the goalie is also a little bit of a leader.
Kind of. Like, you on defense, you're really focused on blocking the goalie. You don't want to... I read somewhere that so much of a goalie's results are just based on the defenseman in front of him.
Mm-hmm.
So... you can have a great goalie, but if they're just leaving open shots, if there's, you just keep turning it over on your end of the rink, it's just, you know, whatever the guy's...
Nobody ever blames a defenseman. They always just blame the goalie. We never say, defenseman, you suck. We say, goalie, you suck.
Well, it's hard. It's harder to figure out. You have to know a lot more about the game to see that this defenseman's in the wrong spot.
Right. But so in that sense, too, though, people, you know, players sometimes do protect the squishy ones, which would be a wizard. Yeah. Okay. Oh, maybe the wizard is the goalie.
Maybe, I don't know.
Or the wizard is the coach.
Oh, maybe. Or maybe the wizard is in the stands drinking beer and throwing things at the players.
Because wizard often is the one, and characters like the wizard, like the invoker, they're often the ones who have to have a view of the whole battlefield. And they're kind of manipulating the other people on the battlefield almost like, you know, chess pieces.
But it could also be kind of like the cleric could be the leader, too.
Yeah.
Maybe our analogy doesn't, it's not as cut and dry as
I thought it was. I thought basketball worked a little bit better.
How would you do this in basketball?
So the basketball, you got your one to your five, your ones are point guard, shooting guard / off guard, small forward, power forward, center, right? Center is your fighter. It's your defender. You need a big, strong guy who can block shots and grab rebounds.
Okay.
So, and now thinking of the classic party, your power forward could either be a striker or another defender, depending on what kind of player he is. If he's kind of, and there's some guys who are really good at both, like you could have kind of like a, well, you could have like Dennis Rodman as like the ultimate, the power forward as a defender. He just was a great defensive player, grabbed tons of rebounds, not so much a scorer. Or you could have someone more like, say, a Dirk Nowitzki when he's playing power forward, who is almost pure offense. He's not much of a defender. Now, at your small forward is also a little bit strange, but I would say the small forward is probably your wizard in the sense of he's kind of a controller guy. The small forward can take on a lot of different roles because he's kind of a tweener between a guard and a power forward.
Mm-hmm.
He's fast or probably has some speed. If he has court vision, like a Scottie Pippen, a point forward, a guy who can pass really well, your small forward is kind of your jack of all trades who kind of controls the ebb and flow, because depending on what he does, that dictates what the rest of the team is going to do in some ways. Your point guard is your leader. That's your cleric. That's your guy who's just running everything. sort of thinking you're small forward is the guy who's kind of can do a little bit of everything, can kind of set up weird situations on the defense. Like if you have a big small forward, like if you moved Dirk Nowitzki to small forward, now he takes a smaller guy down low into the post and just crushes the guy.
You really have thought about this.
I love basketball. And then your shooting guard is your rogue, because shooting guards, all they do is jack up shots. That's all they do. There are some good ones or some great ones. Michael Jordan was a shooting guard. But a lot of shooting guards, they just throw shots up. Like John Starks was a game 7 of the 95-96 finals. Went 2 for 17, just kept throwing up three-pointers. And then there are guys like Todd Day, who any Celtics fans out there remember the awful season in 96-97. Todd Day was the ultimate in the sort of ball hog, off guard, just the guy would score 10 points on 25 shots, which is really bad.
Okay, I'll take your advice on that. Interesting. Very good. And you really have thought about it.
You got me going. Yeah, you got me going.
I can see that. Really quick question, because this, as I was saying before, really plagues my party. When there's lots of monsters out there and we all come barreling into the room and everybody's like running off in different directions, according to the player strategy guide, that is not the best way to handle a fight. What do you guys think is the best tactical maneuver in that situation?
Well, when characters have attacks that target single creatures, they're going to want to focus their fire.
Yes.
The wizard and other characters who have bursts and other powers that affect more than one creature at once has a little more leeway. Although even the wizard should try to catch that monster that the rest of the party is focus firing on in his or her bursts and blasts. Now, if the wizard is doing pure control, sometimes it's actually the opposite, where the wizard wants to lock down a monster or a group of monsters somewhere else on the battlefield, so that everyone else can focus fire on somebody else and not be distracted by all those other guys.
Okay.
And the wizard also wants to blow up groups of minions whenever possible.
Yes, which is always fun.
That is always fun.
But people like the rogue, the ranger, the avenger, most of our strikers should be focusing their fire.
Yeah.
So they can take things down quickly.
Interesting.
Because that's sort of like a good strategy to follow. If you split up, you've ensured you're going to spread your damage out as thinly as possible.
Yeah, there's even a handy little chart in here that shows, like, this is why you should not do what the wild stallions have been doing. Like, we might as well just spend our pictures in there. Like,
it's tempting because everyone's like, oh, I want to take out that guy.
They start hitting you. It's like, what am I supposed to do?
You can't just ignore that. You can't be like, hey.
Turn the other cheek.
Yeah, well, exactly. And it especially becomes dangerous if you're facing monsters that all have special states that they enter as soon as they're bloodied.
Yeah.
If you then have a bunch of them bloodied all at once, say monsters that deal extra damage when they're bloodied, you're ruining yourself by bloodying them all at once.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good point.
So a good rule of thumb is attack the guy that the guy before you attacked.
So before we leave the player strategy guide, what are our alignments? We each took the quiz for ourselves. We'll start with you, Mike.
I am apparently unaligned.
Unaligned.
Because I used a lot of different answers. But again, the goblin question threw me off. There wasn't an option for...
Get your stomach pumped.
Or... Yeah. Like, what's wrong with that taxi home? Yeah. I shouldn't have... Like, those weren't fresh mushrooms from the, grocery store.
And what about you, Shelley?
I was clearly good.
Let me guess, were you good too?
I was good too.
You're both good.
Yeah. Teetering toward unaligned, but mostly good.
I was unaligned. But I had more good answers than anything else.
Thank you very much for the advice. And thank you, Player Strategy Guide, for helping Tabitha become a better wizard.
And thank you for joining us, Player in Chief.
My pleasure.
So, Mike, you have a new role here in Dungeons & Dragons Research and Development. What can you tell us about it?
So, I have been recently promoted to become the general manager of the role-playing game group that essentially puts me in charge of the role-playing game side of things. I don't have absolute power, sadly, but I do have a lot of say in the sort of the tactics and the strategy of the game going forward. Like, for example, just this week, I've spent a lot of time working on our 2012 schedule, Obviously, that's far ahead of, we're recording this in 2010. That's far ahead of what you guys will see out there. But that's generally how far ahead we think. This is really more, and it's a lot of it, it's a mix of the creative side of coming up with good product concepts, kind of looking at what people we think people will be excited about, and is also the business end of looking at it and going, well, given how many copies we think we'll sell, here's how many man hours it takes to work on this book, art budgets and that stuff. So it's kind of it's probably like three quarters the creative side of things in a very big picture way, and one quarter the business side of things, sitting down with the sales team, things like that, and looking at what we should be doing going forward with the brand team as far as themes for products and how we want to package things together. But really the way I see it in the big picture way, my job is just to make people happy about D&D in a big picture way. Just make, the past 2 years I've gone to D&D XP, the convention the sort of the official D&D convention that's in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And I always feel when I'm doing a review of the upcoming books of the year, I want people to be excited. I don't want to be up there kind of giving an overview of a line that people just look and go, well, we've seen this all before. It's kind of boring. I want to have things where people go, oh, wow, that's really neat. Or that's something I never thought they'd do. Isn't that really interesting? You know, to get really people excited about D&D, get people engaged by D&D, and really just look at D&D from a player's point of view and just think, what would get people excited about D&D? So that's really the long and short of it. And there's also some managerial things.
Including now being my boss.
Yes. So I'm not directly your boss.
You are, yes.
You're a developer now. So you have Steve Schubert as your lead. But yeah, that is, you're like, I am, I guess, your boss. So
my big boss.
Your big boss.
That's right. So in your new capacity, will you still be writing books?
I will be doing a fair amount of design work. A lot of the work I'll be doing we'll be focusing on new directions. We may say, let's say, for example...
And this is new directions for the game, not new directions, the musical group in the TV show Glee.
Yes. Wow. That's an interesting reference.
I was getting you back for all the basketball talk.
Thank you. I guess that balances Glee versus basketball. That is in the sense of, let's say, for example, if we were doing a book... Let's say we decided to do a Deities and Demigods for 4th edition. I might look at that and say, well, we could just make a big book with some random god stats in it, but is there some other mechanic we could introduce, something new story-wise we could introduce? And my role would be to sort of come up with a basic idea, work with the designers, work with whoever in the department, but get that work started and then kind of do a proof of concept, a prototype of it, and then find the direction that's most promising and then move from there, pass that along to the design team, they would finish it. But it would be something that would definitely involve the design team. It wouldn't be just me dictating to them. But it's really about trying to find interesting new approaches to D&D. So yeah, a lot of my design work will be early in the process to find those interesting paths. Investigate three paths, see which one is the most promising. On a related note, the podcast, I think, is a good way to get a conversation going with D&D players. So I had posted this in a couple places, I think, on the internet, but I thought I'd repeat it here. If you have any questions about D&D, feel free to drop a line to dndinsider@wizards.com. That is the sort of the email address we use for Q&A here in the podcast. We're going to do a mailbag every edition of the podcast. I can't answer every question. I will try, but right now my workload's pretty high, but I will read everything. And even if you have questions, even if I can't directly answer them, just reading what people are thinking is always useful. So feel free to send questions to me. And like I said, I can't promise I will respond to everything, but I will read everything.
Also, a good reminder for people is, any of you out there, if you have immediate burning rules questions, you can always contact Wizards of the Coast customer service.
Yeah.
Because we have a team of people ready to answer questions about how the game works, especially if you need to know sooner than later.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're going to answer one mailbag question today. This question comes from Grail, and he writes, I am running a campaign, and I am trying out the mystery-style adventure for the first time, and was wondering what are some good ways of leaving clues for your player characters to find during or out of combat. Some people in my party really like talking to NPCs and are fairly creative when it comes to problem solving, while others are much more straightforward, kick in door, kill monsters, take loot kind of people. So Grail doesn't want those kick in the door players to feel left out in a mystery adventure. So what are some tips that we have?
So that is a classic problem people have running D&D campaigns. You have players with conflicting interests. Now, the key, I think, well, is to kind of look at what tolerance does each faction have for the other's preferred approach. You could, for example, have a scene where the players are trying to find a witness to a crime or someone who knows something about a mystery, and that person has guards, or that person's held prisoner somewhere, where the guys who want to fight have a chance to beat down some monsters, but that's directly going to open up the next avenue of the next role-playing scene or the interrogation or something like that. So I think having that action where both sort of needs are met in one scene is a good way to go. I also would try to focus on keeping the action moving in the sense of not getting bogged down for too long in either direction. You don't want to have a huge fight that just goes on for hours and hours, just like you don't want to have a role-playing scene that goes on and on and on. I think most players, if they're being reasonable, will accept that there may be the group's going to do something that they don't think it was the best part of D&D if that scene is short. And I don't mean like 5 minutes, but like a half hour.
Right.
You know, when you have a longer combat, maybe it's interspersed with the guy you're fighting, the you can role play with as you're battling back and forth, you know.
Well, and I often find that that is one of the greatest tools at a DM's disposal for appealing to varying player tastes, and that is role play during the combat encounter.
Yes, definitely.
Because I see again and again when I observe other people's games that they forget that the role playing doesn't have to stop as soon as initiative is rolled.
Exactly.
And many of the most exciting fights that I've seen in D&D are the fights where the villain is talking trash, the villain is monologuing, you know, so you can, as a DM, keep telling the story while, you know, swords are clashing and spells are exploding, and it often makes it more fun. You can sprinkle in clues, not only because, you know, the villain and his or her minions are chatting during the combat, but the encounter location itself can be filled with clues.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, this battle is taking place in this, you know, corrupted fane, and on the altar there is, you know, whatever the MacGuffin is that the PCs are after, or perhaps it's the MacGuffin that leads to the next MacGuffin.
Yeah.
And it can have a role in that battle.
Yeah.
And then everyone can be happy.
Yeah, especially in that one scene, everyone can be happy. And especially if everyone feels like, you know, the scene you're in, if done well, will lead to the scene, you know, you alternate a fight scene with an investigation scene. You always feel like, well, I want to help win this fight, because then that gives us the next clue for this investigation scene, where the other players may, well, I want to get into a fight. Well, this investigation scene, if I help out and we succeed, then I get to go to the next fight or whatever. That's going to set up the next person we have to go fight.
Yeah. I think another important thing to keep the various groups of players happy is for a DM to keep track of how much play time different kinds of play experiences are consuming.
Yeah.
So if there's a role-playing scene that stretches on for an hour or more. I mean, I've seen this happen. In a recent session of my campaign that I ran, there was actually a big investigation into how various townsfolk had been killed. It turned out the townsfolk were the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker. And the players ended up really enjoying the investigation. And it wasn't quite a skill challenge. It was sort of veering toward being one because there was a sequence of skill checks, but I decided I didn't want to turn it formally into a skill challenge. But because this investigation had an important enough role in the story and consumed a lot of playtime, I awarded the group experience points for it as if it had been a combat encounter.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Which would have consumed a comparable amount of time at the table. And I think if the DM makes sure to basically give in-game rewards for meaningful playtime, that makes it so that, you know, at the end of this long role-playing sequence, the guy who wants to clobber monsters because he wants his character to level up, he doesn't feel like it was a big waste of time.
Yeah. Now, one thing to watch out for with investigation stuff is there's always a temptation, I think, for DMs to make this puzzle or this clue really subtle or hard to find. One thing to watch out for is your players are kind of spoiling for a fight. It may be just because they're kind of bored.
Right.
That they've been kind of going around in circles. I try to always make each scene worth the player's time. Like, they don't just go and talk to somebody to learn where they should go next. That's all they learn. You want to try to give them as they investigate and as they move forward, they learn a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. The really nice thing about that approach is, let's say, for example, there is someone in town, someone in this dwarf fortress has betrayed the dwarves and is selling them out to the drow. He's sending the drow messages that let them know when to attack or whatever. If you give the PCs a situation where they learn a little bit more about the person, you know, it's kind of the classic thing, like, well, we know the person who's delivering the messages is left-handed, so how many dwarves are left-handed? There's 20. Well, we know it's a dwarf who works, he's a member of the town guard. Okay, that narrows it down. One of the things that lets players do is you slowly reveal things. Players can feel very smart when they get a few clues and figure it out early. A lot of DMs have a ceiling of, oh, they figured it out too soon, that's bad. But I don't think that's a good attitude to have, because I think the players are clever and feel they're getting ahead of the game. That gives them a real sense of, like, hey, this is why we're not just playing a video game where you have to go through the five screens to get to the sixth screen where you win. If a player who's clever can feel rewarded, like, oh, I put these two things together and I made either a good guess or there's some other subtle hint here that I'm picking up on that I may have otherwise missed, that lets me kind of jump ahead of the game. That's fine. I mean, one of the big things about in a role-playing game is, as DM, if you feel like you have this big mystery baked into your campaign and the players solve it early on, you can just give them the next mystery. You know, there's always something else they can chase.
Exactly.
And it isn't like a computer game where it's just once you've solved it, the game ends, credits roll, and you're done. You can always just kind of rearrange things behind the scene or just come up with, well, that part of the campaign's over now. I'll just think of what's the next thing I want to challenge them with. You know, don't fall so much in love with the mysteries and the questions you've posed that you let that get in the way of the players making progress or feel like they're making meaningful choices. Because when the players try to make a guess and try to jump ahead, they could also be wrong. They could think they've solved it. No, you arrested the wrong dwarf. You know, right. Things like that.
And then that goes back to something I was talking about earlier in the podcast, that if they screw up, that can just introduce fun complications into the story.
And that's another thing to look out for, too, in a mystery-based game. I think there's a tendency for DMs to think of resolutions in terms of extremes. Like, okay, if you make your search DC in this area, or if you succeed in the skill challenge, you will learn the identity of the murderer. If you fail, the murderer will escape. Those are very extreme results. You either solve it or you don't. I like to try to take those results and push them more toward the middle, where it may be, okay, if you succeed in the skill challenge, you'll figure out, you know, which noble family is behind this, which then should give you like a list of like two or three suspects that you can go, or you just go to the noble family and then deal with it there and figure out who's doing it. If you fail, well, maybe that instead just puts you on the wrong trail. You're going to go accuse someone incorrectly. You could still have a chance to recover, or that may just spark a different storyline or a different complication. It doesn't just end the adventure, or on the other hand, it doesn't just let you win the adventure. You know, they're both just set up the next scene. There's chances for, you know, move your results more toward the middle. Don't just think in terms of extremes.
And the other thing is, too, for the DM to pace a mystery.
Yes.
Not dump it all at once.
Oh, yes.
Where suddenly an entire session is consumed by it, unless the players decide that's how they want to spend a session.
Yeah, and that's good. That's that the players are making a choice, and that's a sign of a great campaign. If the players want to do something and they do it, that's good. That's player choice. You know, and that's something that makes D&D fun for players, the feeling of agency. They have a real effect on how the game unfolds.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's a good idea, and especially when you slowly reveal something, it's a good way to keep the players who want fights happy, because maybe the one player who's tracking these strange runes and these hints, you know, that you keep uncovering in the ruins, he can kind of have the fun, the mini play of playing that game of keeping a journal, taking notes, and trying to align these clues to solve this puzzle that other players may have just completely missed. Well, that about wraps up this installment of the D&D podcast. On behalf of Jeremy, I'd like to thank Shelley for coming by, our player in chief. And I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in and listening. As usual, as I mentioned earlier, if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, drop an email to dndinsider@wizards.com. That's the letter N, not an ampersand. And until then, keep playing D&D, and we'll catch you in the next episode.